There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Live sport, the latest headlines, and top debate.
This is The Grill.
Live from Kickers Sports Bar with Tom Urquhart
on DubaiEye1038.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. I hate to disappoint you. No Tom Urquhart today. He will be back next week. He is currently, I believe, over in Ibiza for a wedding. The lucky so-and-so. You have myself, Chris McCarty, Matthew Fortune, the former deputy sports editor of Mail Online. As I often say, at the time, it was the biggest news platform on the planet. Then Matt left. It's now number two, I believe, behind the Sun newspaper, which still beggars belief that does. We're also joined as well by Mark Lomas, former online sports editor at ESPN, as well as Sport 360 right here in Dubai and across the UAE as well. Well, the boys have been with me for the past 2 hours. They will be with me for the next hour. Still plenty to discuss between now and 6 o'clock. We're going to be joined in the next 10 minutes or so by Sean O'Shea. He is the AIK Stockholm, Swedish football, that is, the biggest club in Scandinavia. He will tell us, I'm sure, in the next 10 minutes. First team coach, he's going to be with us. We're also going to be in conversation with Declan Taylor, boxing correspondent, hugely respected over in the UK. He got a front row view to last week's shocker, Andy Ruiz Jr. defeating Anthony Joshua, the unbeaten heavyweight champion, as he was coming into that boxing bout. Madison Square Garden, knocked down not once, not twice, not three times, four times. He would eventually be stopped in the seventh round. One of the biggest shocks in boxing history. I'm delighted to say that we were there to see it as well. I'm not going to rub that in though. There is also the small matter, as one punter has just pointed out. It is the Rugby Union World Cup Under 20s. Matt Fortune will be giving us a full run through of that between now and 6 o'clock. I jest. Don't you worry about that, Matt. I wouldn't do that to you. Ireland, as this gentleman has pointed out, are, well, they're going great guns, defeating England 42 points to 26 on June the 4th, at a few days back. Australia beating Italy 36 points to 12. The defending champions are France. They defeated Fiji 36 points to 20. Wales, they defeated Argentina, who are the host nation for this Under 20 Rugby Union World Cup. They defeated the Argies, the Pumas, by 30 points to 25. So that is ongoing. That will be something that we will keep an eye on, and we may well cross over to Argentina in the next coming days to speak to some of the journos over there. I can tell you as well, not good news for Scotland, beaten by South Africa 43 points to 19. New Zealand, the All Blacks, beating Georgia 45 points to 13. So three groups of four. It is the Rugby Union Under 20 World Cup. We were talking before the break about Eden Hazard. We're talking about Gareth Bale, and the fact we're also talking Chelsea, and that Frank Lampard may be the man to come in there. A couple of other big transfer stories I just want to wrap up, and it's involving one of the men that has starred this season, will star tomorrow, Matthias de Ligt, the Ajax skipper, man who has forged a wonderful partnership at international level with Virgil van Dijk. Netherlands into the final. I hate to rub it in, you boys, because you, of course, are both English. I was delighted to see the Dutch do a number on you boys the other night. But Matthias de Ligt, PSG, I'm hearing the favourites. Barcelona, and I know it's shocking if he goes to PSG, but they are apparently the favourites. Barcelona mentioned, United, Liverpool. I mean, de Ligt is on the move. It's just a case of where, and he is top drawer as well, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing is that it'll be interesting to see him taken out of an environment in which he is the golden boy, because regardless of the amount of money spent on him and the credibility that we have within the dressing room, he is a leader of that team, and one of his greatest strengths is how he drags his team forward. It's going to be very difficult for a 19-year-old lad, regardless of what he's achieved, which is actually not a great deal, a couple of very, very good seasons and the way he's led a team, but a team of peers, should I say, that he's dragged forward, put him into an environment where there's massive expectation, where there's players older than him, where he actually has to learn to take a little bit of a backseat. I'm not trying to rain on his parade at all. He has a lot of growing up to do, whichever club he chooses, and it's such an important decision for him to make. There's a part of me that thinks he probably shouldn't move just yet. Get another season where he now knows exactly what's going to be expected of him in 12 months' time, where he's going to go in. If he goes into Liverpool, for example, he's not going to be the best centre-half at that club, and he's certainly not going to be the captain of that club, because within that club you've got Virgil van Dijk and Jordan Henderson. Matthias de Ligt will be second fiddle to both of those, both in captaincy and at the heart of the defence, and that's a different challenge for him to come and take on. So I think a further year at Ajax, developing himself both as a man and as a player and as someone within the team environment that's not necessarily leading from the front, will be very, very important for him. I would like to see him not move, but I do think that if he's going to have to make that move, he needs to go somewhere where he's going to be somebody with an arm around the shoulder that will help him grow, and that's Liverpool.
I was going to say surely it's Man City. If you're Pep Guardiola, you've got Laporte, who is left-footed centre-half, who had an unbelievable, probably after Van Dijk, the second-best centre-half in the Premier League last season. John Stones, I know, is a young Englishman, and you want to see English clubs promoting English talent. But surely, Pep Guardiola, if he wants a man to fill that void left by Vincent Kompany, De Ligt is tailor-made for Man City.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we've seen that Guardiola's willing to give young centre-backs a chance with John Stones as well. And, you know, ball-playing centre-half, exactly, he seems like he would be a great fit there. I have to disagree with Matt as well. I think a player should move when their star is at its brightest, because you just never know what could happen. You know, he could have peaked early, you know, and he could have a bad season. He could get a terrible injury. I think you have to strike while the iron's hot as a footballer and make the move to a bigger club and test yourself at a bigger club, whether that's Barcelona, Liverpool, Manchester City.
He is a man mountain, in fairness. You look at the size of him for a 19-year-old.
He couldn't handle Marcus Rashford, though, against
England. I mean...
But yeah. he looks like he should be. He's almost a number eight build from rugby, is he not? Big broad shoulders, the way he drives forward. He's almost. This is a terrible comparison. I don't know why it's popping into my head. That Harry Maguire.
Exactly, he is.
That buccaneering style.
He's a good Harry Maguire.
Players bouncing.
He's a very good Harry Maguire.
Players bouncing off him. I just think that, and the thing, you take nothing away from his ability. And I know it's. Mark's probably right. You do move at the right kind of time for you, and you do test yourself at that level.
I take the point, though. You're thinking it's another the, year of being educated.
Because he's not going to be captain. He's not going in at captain.
Well,
and a great...
I've been told he's a huge character. He's someone that really sees the game. He's a smart boy.
He is a smart boy, but he's a 19-year-old boy. And it's very, very different between being the leader of your hometown club, the biggest club in your country.
Listen,
around
Manchester United
have
no leaders, Matthew. We could sign him and make him captain tomorrow.
Okay, so let me ask you this, then. Paul Pogba responds to a captain 7 years younger than him. It doesn't happen. You're dealing with a football dressing room, not that I've ever been in one of any great repute, but a dressing room is something that needs management, not just by proving yourself as a player, but proving yourself as a sort of person that can get within that dressing room environment and fit. And if you come in as a 19-year-old and start barking orders at players far more senior than you, regardless of how you do it, you could do it in the right way and he could be brilliant at it and he could be captain and could be a great success. I'm just saying, looking at it from the outside, the mentality of a captain and a leader of a club in your home country surrounded by your peers, when you're overachieving, all of you individually, to going into a dressing room, if it's Liverpool, that are at the peak of their own powers, fully successful, your international teammate beside you, and you're the one giving the orders, the midfielder are going to turn around and look and think like, not sure I should be listening to you, pal. I've got the best defender in the world alongside you. So it's really difficult, and I just think he knows now. 18 months ago, he didn't know that he was going to have Barcelona knock on his door, Manchester United knocking on his door. He now knows that in 12 months' time, all things being well, that he is going to have the pick of whatever club he wants in Europe. Spend that year learning how it takes to be an ingrained team member and not just the captain.
It's a frightening prospect that you said Liverpool is this maybe go-to destination. We talk about the back five, and I say the back five, you look at the back five that started against Tottenham, Alisson Becker in goals, who is right up there as one of the best goalkeepers in the world. They're two fullbacks for me as a pair. I don't think there's a better fullback in pairing in world football. Andy Robertson, who fundamentally, the last 12 months, best left back in world football. David Alaba, maybe. Right back, Trent Alexander-Arnold, I'm a huge fan of he. And then Virgil van Dijk, Joe Matip. Now, you drop Matip for Joe Gomez when he's fit. That back five, for me, is the best back five in the Premier League. Gomez would be hard done by, but, and as I said to you, and Mark, as you as a United fan, when United were at their peak, you always look to improve, you look to move forward. And if Liverpool were to say to De Ligt, you are the man for us to slot alongside van Dijk, you keep Gomez happy by saying there's four competitions we're going to be competing in. You are also a very good right back to give Trent Alexander-Arnold his break. That's how you move Liverpool on. You say, De Ligt, you at 19 are the best centre-half that we've seen. Probably, when we talk about a dearth of top centre-halves in the last decade, he's the best we've seen in a long time. My goodness, that's a frightening prospect and a sobering prospect.
And it would make Ronald Koeman very, very happy as well to develop that centre-back partnership very nicely with
Virgil.
Georgino
Wijnaldum ahead of them. I mean, it's a frightening prospect. De Ligt, though, he is a class act, and he has the unenviable task of trying to keep a certain Cristiano Ronaldo quiet tomorrow. Just want to touch on the UEFA Nations League. Been a success overall? Have we been happy with it?
As a concept, I think absolutely. I think it's generated interest throughout a period of time where there's not necessarily interest in international football. It's been smart. One thing, though, that, and we discussed it, I think everybody's discussed it, the quality of football that was shown in the Champions League final and the Europa League final, and I'm actually interested to get Shawnee's thoughts on this, in the idea of a long gap between games. And I think the Nations League, considering this was a semi-final and a final, not as much interest as there was in the group stage games before. And I know it's a victim of the calendar of domestic leagues, but it's lost that kind of goodwill that it had, that interest, by dumping it essentially in the middle of June, beginning middle of June. I think if it had been the first thing, as they do, the season finishes on the Saturday and then the international weeks come around.
You'd have seen it the week after.
Absolutely bring it forward. I really think it would have been so much more. In the same way the Champions League, the quality that was shown, or the lack of quality in both the Champions League and the Europa League finals, was probably as a result of 3 week gap between fixtures. Yeah. That's really, really difficult to maintain, I think, then internationally. And then they give them a 4 day turnaround and expect there to be some sort of quality. I think that was a bit of a miss hit on that perspective. But as an overall tournament, the fact we're even talking about it, the fact there was a trophy up for grabs, it was almost coming home for England, I think, so soon after it almost did before. I think it has been really an unqualified success.
A success then. England will not be bringing the trophy home. They will not even be in that final. It is Portugal against Netherlands on Sunday. Third place, but I said, I think it's tomorrow, is Sunday. Third place match, call it what you will, the most meaningless football match, and I think in history, England against Switzerland. Just want to touch, actually, I saw a lot of people, and again, it's all about discussion. There's no right or wrong answer to this. I had a bit of a tit for tat with my good friend Eddie Taylor on social media yesterday about the fact that he was talking about decision making and there needs to be a time where you need to know to get rid. And I was pointing out, well, it's all good and well saying that in hindsight. John Stones, in possession with that football, had an eternity to get rid or do what he wanted. He dilly-dallied. Same with Ross Barkley. The decision to play it out to Ross, it was on his weaker left foot. He tried to put it back into Jordan Pickford. In hindsight, he would have kicked it into Rose Ed. But you don't want to change that. England have had great success over trying to play out from the back.
Absolutely. I think it's just very unfortunate that there were two catastrophic defensive errors in the same match because, you know, I think Matt and I both watched England a lot over the last 10 years. Well, actually, I stopped watching England a lot because they were so boring and so terrible watching them in friendlies and World Cup qualifiers. And the way that they play now is actually exciting, and it is actually making English fans... You know, you saw how many people in Portugal, that partly because it's the Nations League, partly is because England are playing better football now. There's more excitement there with the way they play. And, you know, I don't think you can have it both ways. You can't beg for exciting football, playing out from the back, playing in that, you know, a stylish way for 10 years, and then when it happens, criticise them when something goes wrong. You know, you have to encourage them. As I said, I think it's unfortunate that it happened in the same match. You know, John Stones, he's used to playing that way for Manchester City. Yeah. He's been playing that way all season. Yes, you know, he might make a couple of errors. It's unfortunate it's happened at that stage, but you shouldn't just throw it out the window, all the work that Southgate's done over the past couple of years.
Well, in line with my point about a three-week gap between games, I think that probably played into their hands. They have 3 weeks off, essentially, of competitive football, and it's no wonder those mistakes happen after 90 minutes. They're 110 minutes into a first competitive game in 3 weeks. No wonder their passes are a little off or their brain's drifting a little bit. And that, I think, was the problem. And Mark's absolutely right. You don't throw the baby out with the bathwater just over a couple of mistakes like that.
Gary Neville pointing out that still for him, forget the individual errors. They happen in games. We appreciate that. We respect that. He was pointing out, and he's probably right too, that England's still lacking a Frankie de Jong. Now, a Frankie de Jong doesn't grow on trees. There's an awful lot of national teams not got a Frankie de Jong. Someone that gets on the ball, someone that dictates, someone who can, on the half turn, pick up the ball and thread those little balls through. You looked at that midfield composition. Declan Rice, who I'm a huge fan of, as a destroyer, so an enforcer, someone to sit in front of that back four, making a back three when you're in possession. I get that. Ross Barkley, Fabian Delph, though. I'm a big fan of Ross Barkley, but he isn't, for me, that level. Now, people will point out Jordan Henderson not playing because, of course, he had the Champions League. Eric Dier has not been anywhere near where he needed to be.
I don't think Jordan Henderson's Frankie de Jong level,
and he isn't either. He isn't either. You're right to point that out. But what he is he gives a bit of calm, assurance in that middle of the park. You look around, Mason Mount's young. Harry Winks, I think, is a wonderful little player, Harry Winks. You're not massively not a massive fan of him, Matthew, but I am. I think Harry Winks has potential. Phil Foden undoubtedly has potential. Is that an area now, when we talk about the excitement of Jadon Sancho's, Raheem Sterling's, Marcus Rashford's, you've got Callum Hudson-Odoi coming through as well. You've got so many attacking bright talents, Dele Alli, further forward, Harry Kane. That seems done and dusted from an England perspective. Is now the key to start producing some midfielders who are really technical, who want to get in the ball and enjoy being in possession?
Yeah, Dele Alli was supposed to be that player, obviously, but he hasn't quite kicked on to the level that people would have hoped. But he was that player who can pick up the ball, who can pick out a pass. who can pivot in the middle, and he's the one that I think England are very hopeful about. But disappointing World Cup, I think, last year, and he hasn't really pushed on for Spurs this year, Dele Alli. And
he hasn't.
You're right that I think maybe it's time to look elsewhere for that player, but it doesn't seem to be too forthcoming for England, a player like that. And Ross Barkley as well, you know, you wish that he had that ability to get to the next level, but I think at the stage he's at now, at 25, 26 years old, I think he's reached his level, and I don't think he's going to get any higher, unfortunately.
Well, the two players that come to mind, one is a more serious shout than the other, so I'll give you the other one first.
Jack Wilshere, one of them.
Oh, Jack Wilshere.
Oh, I don't see it.
But moving on from that, you look at someone like James Maddison, talking of transfers earlier,
good.
A lot of interest in him. Probably plays a little bit further forward than that role that we're looking for. But you're looking at a player who's supremely confident, taking ball to feet and making things happen. The problem is at the moment, and it bears out on those mistakes that were made by the players, it's lack of confidence on the ball. Ross Barkley does lots of things very, very well. But you don't ever see him take ball to feet with players at his back and kind of back him to make the right brave decision. So someone like Maddison that just sits a little bit further back. Dele Alli, I think, was the one. But he's maybe got a little bit ambitious in those couple of years since Dele Alli broke onto the scene and has taken a step a little bit further forward, much more of a 10 than maybe the 8 that we thought he might be. So maybe it's at club level if he can start to reshape that a little bit. But if Christian Eriksen leaves Spurs, as we were talking about earlier, that's probably not going to happen.
Get Paul Scholes out of retirement. That's what England need to do, I tell you that right now. Now then, 5:20, stay with us. We are with you for the next 40 minutes. Big man's just walked in. First team coach AIK Stockholm, Sean O'Shea, he's with us next. Stay tuned.
Unbelievable goal!
This is The Grill, live from Kickers Sports Bar, where the game is always on.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. 5:23. I'm keeping an eye on the big screen, and it does look as if the rain has passed over at Roland Garros. Dominic Thiem and Novak Djokovic will be taking to the court for about the 19th time in this semi-final. Dominic Thiem leads that fifth set by 4-1. We'll keep an eye on that for you. It is myself, Chris McCarty, joined by Matt Fortune, by Mark Lomas. We are coming to you from Kickers Sports Bar down here at Dubai Sports City, and a familiar face has joined us as well. He's had a haircut, he's looking resplendent. It is the one and only Sean O'Shea, now first team coach of AIK Stockholm.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
It's wonderful to have you back with us.
It's great, and great in Kickers, because I used to live here.
You did, indeed.
Not in Kickers, obviously.
You had a tent set up in here. This was your kind of home away from home.
It was,
this venue. You're enjoying Stockholm?
Loving it.
Loving being back, though?
Yeah, it's been nice to be back and see people and get some sunshine. But
loving Stockholm.
Yeah, just loving Stockholm, mate. Yes,
living the dream.
Yeah, every day is a dream.
First team coach of AIK Stockholm. I said before you were here, and I'm not sure if you were listening in on the car, biggest club in Scandinavia?
I would like to say so, because
after Östersund, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. But no, I'd say Copenhagen are probably the biggest club.
Are they?
And then us, yeah. I think, like in Swedish football, obviously Malmo are the most decorated club, but for whatever reason, Stockholm is the one that everybody knows.
Friends Arena is your home, a stadium of 50,000. On a regular basis, what are you averaging attendance?
We had the derby on Sunday, we had 35,000. Last three home games of the season last year, 47,000.
Wow.
So we've had some lower ones, like we played in the Cup, it was like 15, 16,000, but you know, it's not derogatory to say no one cares about the Swedish Cup. So,
no.
So like no one goes. It's like a pre-season tournament.
It is.
So
Östersund still won it though a couple of years back, which led to them beating Arsenal at the Emirates, of course. Shawnee, talk to me. Slow start to the campaign.
Yeah.
And I'm not stitching you up here. A slow start. I think people are still getting used to your Yorkshire dulcet tones.
Possibly. Or maybe my terrible Swedish.
One or the other.
Swinglish.
Yes.
But it was a slow start. I think for me, it wasn't a slow start. For me, it's been hectic. But in terms of how we played, I think there was a bit of a hangover from winning the league, and everyone kind of just relaxed a little bit, because they'd worked so hard for 2 years to try and win the league, and it was all like, right, we've won now, and everyone kind of just took the foot off a little bit. And the other thing, of course, is we play 5-3-2, and we've played that for the last 3 years, and everybody knows that. So they know that how we're going to play, and every team that plays against us is the biggest game of their season, so they're very good. They just concentrate on stopping us from playing.
It's interesting you say that. We've been talking, and we'll get Mark and Matt into the conversation in just a moment. We've been talking about Liverpool, for example. We were talking on air, I think, maybe off air as well, about Christian Eriksen would be wonderful for a Liverpool, because he's a bit different from what they have. When you've had great success, the key is to evolve and improve so that you keep your opponents on their toes. With regards to AIK and you coming in, Is there a different philosophy? Have you tweaked things? You were saying there you play 5-3-2.
Yeah.
You still play 5-3-2?
Yeah, we do. We change it for one game against Gothenburg. We got battered 3-0, so we just changed that straight back. One of the most embarrassing moments in my very short football career. But no, we do, but we have tweaked how we play because, like I said, even though we're very good at it, it does become predictable. So we have had to change how we play a little bit. We still play the same shape, but just tactically we just play it a little bit different.
For regular listeners, Swedish football, and we've had Graham Potter on the show, of course, had great success with Östersund, Swansea, now at Brighton. I'll get your thoughts on that in just a second. Swedish football, give us your kind of leveller. Where is the standard at? If we compare it, let's say English football, a lot of people watch the Premier League, the Championship, League One, League Two. Where are we at?
Yeah, I'd say we're somewhere in the Championship. You know, you look at our squad, we've had 11 players gone international duty this week playing for Sweden, Norway, Estonia. So, yeah, it is like, I suppose the weaker teams, the poorer teams like Östersund that you support, probably down in League One somewhere. But I think it's a mixture between the two. But the strong teams, so when you talk about, obviously, AIK, you talk about Malmo, Hammarby, I suppose, Norrköping, Djurgården are doing quite well this year. They would do all right in the Championship, I think.
And what's been the biggest learning curve? Because, of course, regular listeners will also know you were head of football operations in Adolf Sheba.
Yep.
You were dealing with Patrice Evra.
Yep.
You were putting programmes together for Virgil van Dijk. For some top, top players who have gone on, and we'll talk Virgil with you as well,
because
I think there's a pattern emerging. It's when players work with yourself, Shawnee, they go and achieve great things.
I was talking to him last week, and I said that to him.
And what did he say?
No, he just laughed.
Oh, right, fair. I thought he was maybe offering you huge money.
He definitely didn't say thanks. Yes, you're absolutely correct.
Oh, I love it. But what's been the biggest learning curve? What's been the biggest thing you've taken away from the opening few months?
I think it's the pressure from the fans, because I've always loved about Swedish football. And you know, because you've experienced it. The fans are absolutely insane. They're so passionate about the football there. And for me, it's like old school supporters. There's still a big hooligan culture in Sweden, which is absolutely massive. It's rife, and there's a big thing at the moment between the police and like the ultras and all this sort of stuff, which we can talk about. But the pressure from the fans is huge, because when we win, we're all heroes. When we lose, they go for you, like they really go for you. And if you're out and about in the city, you know, the day after a game,
have you had any run-ins?
I've had a couple. Like, the players get it more than I do. I've had it a few times. Most of the run-ins I've had have been quite positive. It was when I first got there and people saying welcome to the city and welcome to the club, and they were really interested in what we were going to do and how the role was going to work and stuff. But you do get it, and like, I don't go on to like the forums and stuff, but a lot of the staff do, and Twitter as well.
Mate,
why'd you do it to yourself?
So I don't do it. I don't get involved in it, because I have my way of working. The manager likes the way that I work, so I just stick to that. And I think if I start reading what, you know, people think about me, then I might change from that, and I don't want to deviate from that.
Matt Busby famously told Sir Alex Ferguson never to ever read the newspapers.
Yeah.
So. You're right.
Luckily, they're in Swedish as well, so I can't read them anyway.
Are you learning the lingo?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, from when I lived in Norway, I still retained a little bit of that, so I can understand conversations. I'm still too embarrassed to reply, because Yorkshire Swedish is not... It's not a pretty thing to hear.
It's when there's a picture of you on the front page dressed up as a turnip that you know you probably... Yeah. It's not gone so well.
That happens every Saturday night.
Matt was making a point just before you came on. It'd be quite interesting to get your thoughts on it, because the Swedish league, by its very nature, is quite stop-start.
Yeah.
We're talking about, and I have, there's no doubt in my mind, the UEFA Champions League, June the 1st, as it was, 3 weeks after the league season had concluded, there was a contributing factor in the spectacle, or the lack of spectacle, that we saw in Madrid. How do you manage that? How do you coach that, the little peaks and the troughs? Because you've been on a wonderful run. You won a couple of derbies. I think you beat, what, Djurgården?
Yeah, I beat Djurgården and Hammarby in the space of 2 weeks.
So your star, your flag is flying high. Then you're off. International break. I appreciate the come along. You've come out here. The players have gone away on international duty. Some players have had probably the week off to chill.
Yeah.
How do you manage that?
Yeah, well, that's where Mr. Mike Lawson comes in, because it's all about the fitness coach and the sports science side behind it. So, you know, we always plan our weeks from one game to the next, and how many conditioning sessions we can do. And then, of course, now we have this break, and it's hard for us because half the players are in international duty and half the players are off. Then we come back in with half the players, and the international lads get a week off. But then we have 10 days to build back up again for the next one. So we've got a mini camp where we go away for 2 days.
And that's a mini pre-season again.
Yeah, we just train one day, then we play this friendly. But then when we come back, we've got 5 days of building back up. So it'll be a restart session. It'll be two conditioning sessions, which will be like a short, sharp conditioning session, and then like a high-speed one the next day. And then it'll be two tactical sessions, and then we're back into the game. But it's just managed through the beauty of sports science. That's where that is key. So you need whoever's in charge of that needs to be bang on with it. And you have to be in touch with all the international coaches, and you need to know exactly what the players have done so you can factor that in terms of days of rest, time of recovery, how many minutes did they play, all that kind of thing. So it's a bit of a minefield, but they know their job, they're on with it.
Does it favour you a bit in terms of the Champions League and Europa League qualifiers, because you're playing those when you're in the middle of the season, when you're in full flow, whereas other teams are often coming into those games in their pre-season?
There is a train of thought that says that, but we were just going through our schedule for when we come back, and like we play Kalmar on the Saturday the 4th, I think it is. But once we've got the draw, if we're playing away on the Tuesday, we'll play Saturday, we'll get back into Stockholm at midnight, then we might have to fly on Sunday, train Monday, play Tuesday, fly back Wednesday, and then maybe get a day off and then play Saturday. So, yeah, in terms of the condition of the players, yeah, we'd probably be fitter than lads who are coming in for pre-season. But in terms of fatigue from travelling and multiple games over multiple days, it'd be quite difficult.
And the Swedish FA would not move that Kalmar game to the Friday?
No, they wouldn't.
Because we're starting to see that more and more now.
They did it for Malmo last year, actually. They might do. If we get drawn somewhere far away on the Tuesday, there might be a shout to bring that game forward to maybe the Friday.
Now, obviously, you're not going to sit here on Dubai 103.8 radio and tell us who your transfer targets are, etc. But we've seen often enough.
Scandinavia, I can if you want.
Oh, let's do it. There's going to be no one from Sweden listening, I'm sure. Maybe one or two, actually, that will be tuning in. But in terms of the plan, because we've talked off air, we're good friends, we stay in touch.
Well, we try to stay in touch.
Well, I'm terrible.
But you're terrible for
it. I am terrible. I hold my hands up for that. But when we talk about tactics from a transfer strategy point of view, because Scottish clubs, Celtic do it, Rangers do it if they were in the Champions League, you hedge your bet a little bit. You don't want to go all in because you may not qualify for the group stages. How is AIK Stockholm playing this? Because you've started the season with one pool of players. Are you about to invest in four or five?
The really honest answer, which is really boring, is I don't know.
Really?
Because Bilby's, look, it's down to the sports director, because they're the ones, like, we talk obviously as a coaching team saying, right, where do we need to improve? Because we've got a couple of players on loan that are going to be leaving. Where do we think we're possibly weak or where we need to strengthen? Yeah, we're going into the Champions League, so where do we need that experience that might get us over the line into the group stage of either Europa League or Champions League? But ultimately, it's down to the sport. It's not even really down to the manager, it's down to the sports director. They're going to, with the head of recruitment, they'll identify those types of players and they'll go out and speak to them. So when it comes to signing players, to be honest, we find out maybe a day before they announce it in the press.
So let's get an exclusive that I can sell back to the Scottish Sun in Scotland. Mikael Lustig, is he coming to AIK Stockholm?
I couldn't tell you, mate, but there's a very strong rumour that Scottish player Chris McCarty is going to be our third goalkeeper.
Oh, I love that. I'll take that all day long.
Someone's going to have to teach him to count his 6-yard box before you do that.
And also catch, kick and look like a footballer.
Hey, I got best shot stopper in Dubai, that's for sure. Listen, keep it locked. If you've got any questions for Shawnee, incidentally, first team coach of AIK Stockholm, get it in on 4001. We're with you for the next half hour. We're going to be talking a little bit of boxing, but we're going to come back to the conversation with Shawnee, because there's so much other things to discuss with him as well. One of those things has to be the nightlife over in Stockholm as well. We will be discussing that. Stay tuned.
Unbelievable goal!
This is The Grill, live from Kickers Sports Bar, where the game is always on.
Yeah, welcome back to our broadcast down here at Kickers Sports Bar. 25-6, we're into the final 25 minutes or so. We're keeping an eye on the ICC Cricket World Cup. It's day 10, England taking on Bangladesh. We're keeping an eye on that second men's semi-final. It goes on and on and on. It is Novak Djokovic against Dominic Thiem. We'll have updates on that in just a moment. For now, though, we've also got Sean O'Shea, AIK Stockholm first team coach. He's alongside us. I'm also joined by Matt Fortune, former deputy sports editor of Mail Online. Mark Lomas as well, the former ESPN online editor as well, and I'm delighted to say to bring into the conversation now, we can be joined by a man who was ringside last Saturday, Anthony Joshua against Andy Ruiz Jr. It was one of the biggest shocks, certainly in heavyweight division, if not boxing. It was incredible. Andy Ruiz Jr., a 20-1 outsider, knocked down AJ not once, not twice, not three times, but four times to take the three belts away from the undefeated Anthony Joshua. That man, delighted to say, joins us now. Good friend of Matthew Fortune's, Declan Taylor, boxing correspondent, sports journalist, joins us live from the UK. A very good afternoon to you, Declan.
Hi guys, how are you?
Very good indeed, my man, very good. We are still, I guess, trying to make sense of what we witnessed over at Madison Square Garden last Saturday. We were very fortunate enough to be there as well, Declan, to watch it all unfold. It was quite incredible. Let me ask you this question. Did it come as a surprise to you, as it did probably to 99.9999% of the watching public?
yeah, I'm not gonna pretend that I thought Ruiz was gonna win. I thought he'd be done and dusted, sort of after four or five rounds, and it looked like that was gonna be the case, didn't it? When Joshua caught him with that left hook, stuck him on the canvas, you thought, well, that's it. He's, you know, another one in the books. But no, it all changed. And to be honest, that was the key moment. Forget about conspiracy theories about Joshua's state of mind and whatever else. Andy Ruiz had a good enough chin to get caught like that and still get up and fight back. So full credit to him. What an upset. You know, one of the greatest ever.
No doubt about it. You've called it right there, one of the biggest ever. You've called them conspiracy theories. That was going to be my next question. What are you hearing, Declan, and all of this nonsense? There was various tweets doing the rounds, zooming in on the gum shield movement. There was the eyes twitching before the fight. A lot of suggestions that he had a panic attack, did AJ? Some suggestion that he never wanted to fight Andy Ruiz Jr. What is the truth as to how you know it?
Well, do you know, I'm not going to claim that I thought Ruiz was going to win, but during the introductions, I thought Joshua looked a bit strange. You know, he had his gum shield hanging out and he was very low-key, and I just thought, because I've been at all of, covered every single one of Joshua's fights as a professional apart from one, and he's never looked like that. And I thought he was maybe putting on an act because it was an American debut, he wanted to look really cool or whatever, but I think there's more to it than that. Yeah, there's rumours of a panic attack. Apparently he got knocked out in sparring the week before. I heard that he woke up on the day of the fight and he was just a different guy, and he wasn't in the zone as he usually is. And I wonder, what I personally think is that he underestimated the reach. Maybe he didn't put it in training, and then it had dawned on him on the morning of the fight, hold on a sec, I haven't done my usual work here. Have I messed this up? You know, am I in trouble? And I think that he was nervous, actually. And it was a big debut, like you said, it was a lot of stake, American debut, and I think it all caught up with him. And then, you know, in the end, he almost managed to paper over the crack by knocking him out in the third round. But back he came. And I don't, to be honest, I think he got caught badly by the left hook and he got concussed straight away and he never really recovered. So I think, you know, when it comes down to it, that was the key. He got hit hard in the head and he didn't recover. But I think something will come out in the wash. Whether we'll ever hear about it, what the real reason was, I'm not sure. But there was something not right on the night.
So much is made about losing the O record for boxers. You know, Fury and Wilder have still got theirs. What does it mean for Joshua going forward to have one loss on his record? Is it really that bad? You know, we've seen a lot of the great heavyweights have suffered defeats. So, does it really matter in the grand scheme of things for Anthony Joshua?
No, do you know what? I've never been one to really focus on the undefeated record, because, like you say, all the greats, Muhammad Ali, you know, George Foreman, they've all got beaten. Roberto Duran, even Sugar Ray Leonard, you know, it's not a problem. But I think the problem here is not the one on his record, it's the nature in which he was beaten. You know, he was invincible to most people who, certainly out sort of casual fans, thought that Joshua was Superman. But the manner in which he got beaten, bounced up and down, like you mentioned, and then effectively quit in his corner, really, that's what's going to damage him. Not the fact that he's lost, but it's the nature of his defeat. You know, if he got knocked out by one punch, like Lennox Lewis did against Haseem Rahman, for instance, you can come back. You can say, oh, it was a lucky punch, I'll be fine next time. But he didn't. He got beaten up for, what was it, seven rounds. And he's got to try and get that invincibility cloak back. And I'm not sure he ever will. And it's interesting to see what's going to happen now, because someone like Deontay Wilder will look at that and be licking his lips.
Well, that's the thing, Dick. It's actually made the heavyweight division kind of interesting from a wider perspective, yep. Of course, because no one saw it coming, of course. And now that those belts are on the line, do you think AJ's taken the right course of action in calling for that immediate rematch? Because he was ultimately, wasn't, like you say, caught by one lucky punch in the way that Lewis was against Rahman. He was beat up proper. To be put down four times, there's obviously something that Ruiz has that AJ can't handle. Would it have been better of him to take a step back, think about the next opponent and pick a couple of smarter decisions to then be able to move forward and get a shot quicker that he would do at Wilder or at Fury? Because judging by those seven rounds that, of course, we saw, Ruiz will probably beat him again, won't he?
Yeah, 100%. I think, obviously, contractually, he can have that immediate rematch and then he gets an immediate crack at the belts that he's lost. But so that's why they're doing it, because they think, right, let's just get those belts back and get in that position of power again. But you look throughout history, a lot of the times when you get beaten up like that, the last person you want to be stood across from in your next fight is the guy who did it. Look at David Price, another big, high-profile British heavyweight. He got stopped by Tony Thompson, went straight into the rematch. And psychologically, he wasn't there because he knew what Thompson had done to him 6 months earlier. And if it was me, I'd say, go away, knock out a couple of people, get your confidence back. You're Anthony Joshua, you're always a big draw, you're high profile, you're going to be able to get world title shots down the line. You don't have to rush into it. I worry for him because Andrew Ruiz as well will be so full of confidence. He'll feel unbeatable now going into that rematch. Joshua, on the other hand, is going to be gun-shy, you would think. You know, look what happened last time he tried to unload against him. He got clipped with a left hook and the fight changed. He'll know that. I worry for him in the rematch, I do. And if he loses a second time to Andrew Ruiz, where does he go from there? You know, he could be talking about retirement straight away.
Well, that's a big thing for me, Dick. You look at AJ, he's more than a boxer, isn't he? It's brand AJ. You touched on it and we saw it selling merch, properly branded up, gloves and hats, and it's all about the brand. And he's a big part of the DAZN step into America. He's a big part of Matchroom. Do you think there's a little bit too much invested in him as that brand rather than that fighter? And they've almost let their heart rule their head by going for this rematch and thinking we can't have him on the back foot, not selling out venues with a couple of duds on the way to making his step forward, and that's going to be the big undoing of him.
Yeah, I think what they're hoping, and I hope as well for Joshua's sake, that they'll look at something that happened in the camp, whether he got knocked out in sparring, whether he had a panic attack or there was some underlying issue, and they'll say, look, if that doesn't happen next time, it's a different fight. Whereas if it was a perfect camp and that still happened to him, then he's in serious trouble. I think commercially, he's such a huge commodity now that, yeah, you're right, it does sometimes rule the boxing side. I don't know how that translates into how he trains and stuff, because we're not really privy to it. They're very private. You're allowed up once in the build-up in terms of media access. So you don't really see how it works day-to-day. I mean, he always looks in amazing shape, so you can't really have a go at him for that. But I just worry whether it takes a toll. You know, every time you leave the house, you've got to think about, you know, where you're going, what car you're driving, what drinks bottle you're sipping out of in case you get photographs. You know, it's going to take a mental toll on him. And has it all caught up? Maybe. I mean, but look, if he knocked out Ruiz in that third round, we're not talking about this. So it's always, you have to sort of take stock after a defeat. And I wonder if they really are by going straight into the rematch. But then, you know, he wins it, gets his belts back. He's the most powerful heavyweight in the world again.
Yeah, you've talked there, Dick, about the panic attack or the speculated, alleged panic attack. And whatever the reasons were in camp, whether he was knocked out or knocked down in sparring, one individual who has come in for an awful lot of criticism is his trainer, Rob McCracken. Interested to read comments from Lennox Lewis likening him to a high school teacher or a college teacher, not a professor, not someone who he feels has the skill set, the requisite skill set to take AJ to the next level. There was also a meme that did the round or a tweet that went out showing AJ's team. It's like 26 individuals, for goodness sake, all surrounding him. Is there not a suggestion that, well, I'll ask you, it's a kind of two-pronged approach. Rob McCracken, A, is he the right man? And B, is there too many cooks spoiling the broth with AJ?
Well, not on the McCracken issue. I think he's, without doubt, one of the best trainers in the country. Lennox has a go at Joshua a lot. I don't know why, but he seems to take umbrage with a lot of things he does. So I took that with a bit of a pinch of salt, the McCracken comment. But you've got to say, he's been with him a long time, you know, throughout the amateurs. Would he learn, you know, something else with a new trainer? Who knows? But the instructions that he was giving Joshua during the rounds were perfect. They were spot on. So, you know, it's not even as if he got it wrong on the night, but Joshua got caught and he got, as far as I can see, he got concussed. And then, you know, a trainer can't really help that. He told him to get behind the jab. He told him to get back to his boxing, which is what he should have done, and he just couldn't. So you can't really have a go at McCracken to that. I think he's the man to take Joshua forward, 100%. On the subject of his team, look, it's not like an entourage that's sort of been dragged together over the last couple of years. These are his mates and people who have been around him from the start. So it's not, you know, new friends in that sense. It's still people he can trust, who he feels safe and comfortable around. A lot of the time, as soon as boxers start shedding these people, they feel a bit lost. They feel unsafe. Amir Khan's one of these people who, you know, a lot of his team and his mates left him. And then he feels on his own. So he needs that support network and that comfort around him. So he might even be worse off, you know, should he start trimming down that team. And again, we're only talking about it because he lost. I don't think the presence of those guys around him had any bearing on the fight. And I think if they were, you know, if he was to start chopping everyone away and saying, you know, you don't deserve to be here, what are you doing here? I think actually it might hinder him going forward. So I've got no problem with that, and I've got no problem with McCracken. What I have got a problem with is Joshua rushing in and getting caught with a left hook.
Yeah, fair point to that one, Declan. The rematch is set. We don't know exactly where. We're expecting Cardiff, correct?
I would think so, because obviously it's the only one over here with a roof on it. It's going to be November, December, so you couldn't do it at Wembley. The O2 is too small, so I would say Cardiff is probably the the sort of favourite at the moment.
We're expecting Cardiff. Last one from us and we'll let you get going, Dick. We really appreciate you spending some time chatting to us this afternoon. Of course, Madison Square Garden, centre stage once again this evening. Gennady Golovkin, Triple G going up against Steve Rawls. There's going to be no lightning striking twice and another upset there, is there?
Well, I know. I mean, if you'd asked me this last week, I would have said absolutely no chance. But look, you can't really take anything for granted. Golovkin as well, let's not forget, he's got a new trainer in Jonathan Banks, so he's not with Abel Sanchez. Who knows what might happen? He might be complacent. He might have had a panic attack or got chinned last week. You just never know. But, you know, if you had a gun to my head, I'd put my mortgage on Golovkin winning, probably by stoppage. But, you know, that's the thing with these sorts of results. It just makes you reconsider your whole viewpoint. The same with Tyson Fury next week in Vegas. You know, you think he's going to win easy, but you just never know. But, yeah, smart money, obviously, Golovkin, early victory, and he marches on to a Canelo trilogy fight in September.
Oh, I tell you what, whetting the appetite already. Listen, Declan, I admire your work, my friend. Keep up the great stuff. Thank you so much for spending 10 minutes to have a chat with us. And enjoy that rematch when it turns around.
Nice one, I'll try.
Declan Taylor there, boxing purist, boxing correspondent, boxing writer, a man that knows his stuff, and I think we're all in agreement that that rematch is going to be a bit hairy for Anthony Joshua. There's no cast iron guarantee that he wins that and gets those belts back. When we come back into the final stages of the show, Sean O'Shea's with us, Mark Lomas, Matthew Fortune, myself, Chris McCarty. We're keeping an eye on the tennis because Novak Djokovic has fought his way back into this fifth and final set. Stay tuned.
You're listening to The Grill, bringing you the biggest sports stories right now.
On Dubai i103.8.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. Just gone 10 to 6 on your Saturday afternoon into the evening. We're into the home straight here down at Kickers Sports Bar. It is a brand new home this summer. We will be keeping an eye. It is your official, or Dubai i103.8's official summer home. The ICC Cricket World Cup, French Open will conclude this weekend, of course, but then there is the small matter of the FIFA Women's World Cup. It's ongoing. We'll be keeping an eye on Allsvenskan as well. For those of you out there that aren't aware of what Allsvenskan is, it is, of course, Shawnee,
the Swedish Premier League.
Yeah, we'll be doing that as well. Keeping an eye on AIK Stockholm. There's so much this summer to look forward to. There is the US Open, which starts next Thursday from a golfing standpoint as well. Rory McIlroy needs to do something. Brooks Koepka, four of the last eight, the big bruiser, has won in the world of golf majors. In terms of you, Shawnee, though, you're heading back tomorrow.
Yes, mate, yeah.
Another week off or back into training?
No, straight back to it. Straight back into it on Monday morning. So, the lads who've had a week off, the same as us, are all back in for training. The lads who are playing international duty are back in the following week, and then we get going again.
Let me ask you a question, Shawnee. I'm interested. From a Swedish football perspective,
yep,
it's obviously not one of the biggest leagues in Europe, one of
the
big five.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
That's why Shawnee got a job.
I'm curious.
With all due respect.
I'm curious from a development perspective, how a club like yours looks at a season. Do you look at locking down domestic dominance and anything above that is an extra benefit because obviously you get a little bit more cash the further you progress in Europe from a brand awareness perspective, from a success perspective, players that you can attract? Or is there a kind of unified approach from the teams, those top teams in Sweden, to try and make a little bit more penetration into those more considered bigger leagues?
Yeah, I mean, I think my opinion is more of a unified thing with the top teams to try and crack into Europe like Malmo have done. We have spoken a lot with Copenhagen, for example, because they're quite a very good model for Scandinavian country because they've managed to break into group stages of European football over the last few seasons. So for us, I can only speak for us really directly, and we have a plan now with the club that we want to be in the top 100 clubs in Europe within the next 3 years. And Nike are a big, big sponsor for us now as well. We're like a top category sponsor with Nike. So for us, we have to consistently play in Europe to achieve that target. So from our point of view, 100%, it's not just about dominance domestically. We want to get into group stage of European football and consistently as well.
I was just going to say, is the financial side of that really important? I went to watch a Swedish league game a couple of seasons ago, and the lads that I was speaking to just said that Malmo, because they had got into the Champions League group stage, had like gone far, far ahead of everyone else in terms of the money that they were bringing in. So how much of a difference can Champions League group stage make, for example?
Yeah, it can make for Malmo, certainly makes a huge difference, because Malmo, and it's no disrespect to them, it's not an attractive city to go to, where Stockholm is. So with us being a big club and a big fan base and good sponsors, we have quite a lot of revenue come through the club, and we can pay decent money to players. You know, we've got Sebastian Larsson playing for us, we've got Kolbeinn Sigþórsson playing for us, so we've got big names playing for us, and we can afford them without European football. But yeah, of course, the rewards that come with even just getting into the group stages and maybe not winning a game, you're still going to increase your revenue, and that means you can bring in better players. But there's a big thing in Sweden that I really like, because for me, football isn't tainted by money in Sweden. So the young players are really, really hungry, because they love the game and they're not spoiled at 16, 17, 18. They have to work for the money. There are lads probably that play in the Premier League or in the Swedish top division who might only earn 40 or 50 grand a year. Do you know what I mean? So they have to work for that. So it keeps them hungry and it keeps them ambitious. And for them, it's all about developing to be the best player they can be, to get a move into Germany, into Russia, into these kind of countries where a lot of Swedish players go.
How much emphasis is placed on youth? How much control? How much access do the young boys have to you and the top coaching team?
Yeah, we've got three young players, two that have come through the academy that are playing. So Bilal Hussein, he started the last three games up to the Hammarby game, done really, really well, and he's a smashing player. He played for the Swedish under-19s yesterday. We've got Saku Yilatupa, who plays for Finland. He's in the Finnish under-21, so he's with us. And Adam Benlamin plays for the under-17s as well. Oh, and Jack Lahn as well is playing for the under-19s. So we've got young players that we're trying to develop, who will come from either from the club, or we've brought in young that we're trying to develop into first-team players and stay with the club. But obviously, again, developing those players and moving them on when the time's right for a decent price is also important for the club.
How important is that? It is fascinating listening to you say it must be a dream working with people who are hungry.
Oh,
we know the Premier League has sold its soul to we know who a long time ago in terms of kids now. One good game, I mean, I always use the example of Andy Carroll. He had scored 10 Premier League goals, for goodness sake, and Liverpool spent £35 million on him.
Yeah, it's crazy. Look, I've worked with a lot of Premier League footballers, and they're all good guys, but some of them are hungry than us. That all comes down to their individual mindset. But going to work every day, honestly, is a dream. There are no bad eggs in our squad. There's no one that can be, you know, a bit sort of bring the sort of mood of the dressing room down. There's no kind of snakes in there or rats in there that you find in other countries in football. Everyone's there to work hard. Everyone does what we ask them to do. Yeah, of course, we have the odd problems with players and players get upset when they're not playing. That's just part and parcel of the game. But on the whole, attitude is tremendous. And they come in and they do everything we ask and they do it to the best of their ability.
So no regrets over the decision?
No, not at all, mate. Look, Dubai's a great place and it was very, very good for me and the stuff that I got to do and the players that I got to work with. But it was just time for me to move on, and it was the right time, right club, right place. And it's been a great move.
I'll get a prediction for you. UEFA Nations League final, England, thankfully, and I can say this to you, because although you've got a Yorkshire accent, you always say, or you always claim to tell us you're Irish.
Yorkshire's like, well, Huddersfield's like an extra Irish state, I think.
It is.
The amount of Irish people.
We'll give you that then. So England are not winning it. Who will win it tomorrow? Netherlands, Portugal. Did you watch the semis?
I did. I didn't see the Portugal game, but I saw the Holland, England. I think Holland will win it.
You think?
I think, yeah. I just think that they're playing really well. I mean, I thought they were very good to come back and beat England. And with Van Dijk and De Ligt at centre half, they're going to be very, very tough to break down.
We were talking earlier about top clubs looking at the lift. The RK Stockholm, you going to put a bid in?
We did put a bid in.
Aye.
Yeah, got rejected. Yeah, sadly.
No surprise there. I'll finish up with the boys as well. Fortune for you. Final tomorrow, UEFA Nations League, Portugal, Netherlands. Ronaldo to steal the show, or the Dutch, the collective against the individual?
Well, you say they're going to be difficult to break down, the Dutch. If one man can do it, would be Cristiano Ronaldo, but I do fancy the Dutch. I love the project. They're a fine example of what happens when things go wrong and how to reset and then sort out those foundations and make sure that you can move forward. And I think it would be just rewards for them doing football the right way at international level.
So Dutch, you're going to stick with Ronaldo, aren't you, Mark?
Absolutely, yeah.
I thought you were.
Portugal to win on home soil to cast aside the demons of Euro 2004 when they lost to Greece.
Are you a Man United fan?
Of course he is.
I'm not going to say that live on air, sure.
Okay.
Chris
does all the time.
Ronaldo, obviously, absolutely semi-final, world-class, won it on his own hat-trick. I think he could be the difference again in the final.
We talk about the youth coming through. The Netherlands, of course, have been standard bearers for that. You look at Portugal as well. João Felix, Ruben Dias, the centre-half from Benfica. Victor Lindelof, Swede, who played Benfica as well.
Yeah, he did,
Benfica,
from a very young age.
From a very young age. So, Portugal are coming again. Bruno Fernandes as well, the Sporting Lisbon boy. They have got an awful lot of youth coming through. Two teams probably, with France, the standard bearer from a World Cup perspective, Portugal and Netherlands on an upward curve.
Yeah, I'd say so, yeah.
So two Netherlands. I'm going to go with you boys. I think the Netherlands.
Yeah.
I think the Netherlands will just prove to be too good. Although one area that I think they need a striker. Memphis Depay has that foot. Although he played well against England as the false nine, I still think the Dutch are a Ruud van Nistelrooy away.
Who's the young lad who plays for Ajax up front, the young Dutch striker? What's he called? He's with D, is it?
Oh no, he's Danish.
Oh, he's a Danish.
Dahlberg.
Oh, he's Danish, yeah.
He's Danish, yeah.
What happened to... I know we're running out of time. Dahlberg. What happened to Kluivert's son at Roma last season? Because that was a big money move, Justin.
In and out. Yeah. In and out of the team. Roma need a manager who's going to... Is Josie's not got a job yet, has he? Some suggestion that Josie may be heading there, which may well... Although Justin and Josie get on very well, but...
Also, Ryan Babel's keeping him out of the team.
Yeah, Ryan Babel is keeping him out of the team at the Netherlands. Quite incredible. Right, that is it for us this evening. Sean O'Shea, lovely to hear from you.
Been an absolute pleasure.
Keep
thank
that
you,
phone on and we'll maybe catch up with you in a few weeks' time.
You can always call me, Chris, you know that.
Mark Lomas, big thank you to you, my man.
Cheers, Chris. Absolute pleasure as always. Pleasure.
Thank you so much. You were in at 4 a.m. this morning, you trooper. You've had about 15 cups of coffee. You've seen it through. Bed for you. Matthew Fortune, thank you to you, my man.
Thanks, Chris. I'm going to try and avoid seeing you next week.
Cheers.
That's quite enough, to be honest.
It's been 5 weeks. I could do with a break as well. Big thank you to each and every one of you for tuning in. That is it for us, The Grill, 3 hours down, talking all things sport. You're coming to you live from a brand new venue. Over the course of the next 8 weeks, it is Kickers down here at Dubai Sports City. Happy hour 3 until 7 every single day. Beverages on sale for as little as 19 dirhams. All of that, much more we'll tell you about as we go this week. I am back from 5 o'clock tomorrow evening on Off Script, joining again Robbie Greenfield and Sonal Rapani. Until then, good night.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.